Taking a different track today, what I'm going to be doing is giving over some Divrei Torah on Pesach. These are actually my favorite Divrei Torah on Pesach. So this is, over the past few years, I've collected various Divrei Torah. This is my favorites, and what I'm hoping is you'll be able to remember it or jot them down and be able to share them at your Siddurim also. So that's my hope. So I'm going to go through. They don't relate. Probably we'll get through 4, 5, 6, something like that. And hopefully we'll have interesting Divrei Torah at the Siddurim and interesting lessons that we can learn from each. Okay, so we're going to start as follows. This is number one. Rabbi Abraham Tversky asks the following question. This is the holiday of Pesach, which is Man Chayruseinu, is another word. Man Chayruseinu is the time of our, what is Chayruseinu?
Freedom.
Liberation.
Yeah.
Liberate. Well, Chayrus it was the oppression, and now it's coming. It's a emancipation. If you're an American, you know, the Emancipation Proclamation. So it's a time of freedom, liberation. And the question is, what message can we incorporate into our lives? Because it's very easy to think about Pesach as a historical fact, something that happened in the past, something that happened to our ancestors. We know that we are supposed to envision it as if ourselves are coming out of Egypt. That is very difficult to do. So what message can we come out going into Pesach and then coming out of our Pesach to make it very practical for us? So Rabbi Tversky tells the following story. As a patient of his, if you don't know Rabbi Abraham Tversky, his expertise is also a Hasidic Rebbe. He's one of the famous Milwaukee Tversky family. And his expertise, there were, like, if I remember correctly, 5 brothers. 4 of them, they're all rabbis, all brilliant. 4 of them went into careers. One became an accountant in addition to rabbi. One became a professor in a law school, taught professor in a law school in Brooklyn Law. Now he's actually a dean of Hofstra. Now he's in, So Abraham Tversky, his expert, he became a psychiatrist, psychologist. I think he has degrees in both probably. And he founded and ran for decades a rehab center in Pittsburgh, drug and alcohol rehab. If you can imagine, Abraham Tversky, Hasidic Rebbe, and that's what he's running. And he says that one of his patients told him the following story. He was sitting at the Seder, and his father starts singing, as we do at the beginning of the Seder, Avadim Hayinu. We were slaves, and now we're freemen. And the patient, meaning the son at the Seder, turns to his father and says, Dad, Tati, father, Abba, whatever he called him, you have no clue what it is to be a slave. You have no concept what it is. Your ancestors were slaves, but you have no clue. I, on the other hand, when I was using drugs, I was a slave. I was a slave to my drugs. I was a slave to my habit. And anything that the drugs dictated, that's an addiction. Anything that the drugs dictated me to do, I had to do it. They told me I need more drugs. It's the seal to do this, to do that. And I was 100% controlled by my addiction, and that is a slavery. And Rabbi Dr. Tversky learned from that something that is very, very tangible and real for us, that when it comes to Pesach, although that was a physical slavery, he says slavery is not limited to a despotic paro or a slave owner. We can be a slave not only to an owner, a servant, a slave, but we can be slaves to what else? We can be slaves to how ourselves. Thank you, Zach. How?
By peer pressure, then temptation. Yeah.
Very good. So we can be slaves, and we're going to get to this and this. This is very good. We can be slaves to our work. If we're working on all the time, if we're constantly working, and that's all that's on our mind, and there are people like that. When I was at a law firm when I started working in 95, there was a guy, I don't know if you guys will be able to understand the numbers because you've never done this, but he was billing 3,000 hours a year. 3,000 hours a year. He was billing...
How much of that a week?
Whatever it works out to, it was if divided by 12, it would be by the month. So it was like 280 or something. You know, I was trying to get 180. That was like the average. And he was like... He was walking to the bathroom reading contracts. That's how it was. He was... Wherever it was, that is someone who is a slave to his work. We can be a slave to our work. We can be a slave to our habits. We can be a slave to our bad habits. We can be a slave to many, many, many things. And he says that we can be a slave to cigarettes. We can be a slave to gambling, food, the internet. And then we're going to get what you exactly said, Zach. A person whose self-concept is dependent on what others think of him. If we're always concerned, what is they going to think about me? Who are we acting for? Ourselves? Or we're doing others. We're always doing what somebody else is, what I think he wants me to do, or whose behavior is totally determined by what he thinks others want him to be. That is a person who also has no freedom. That is also no freedom. So the Haggadah is not only about becoming free physically, but becoming free emotionally. Meaning this is the time that should have introspection and be thinking about what are the things that we need to cut free from also. Be it people telling us to not go back Shanabed. Whatever it is. Whatever the issue is. Parents telling us don't go back Shanabed. That's slavery. You need to go back Shanabed. Whatever it is. Give him my phone number. Whatever it may be, that is a form of slavery, that Pesach is a time that we have to think about. Just like our ancestors were redeemed, liberated, so too we should try to be liberated from the things that are constraining us. So that is an important message that we should pull out of Pesach. Okay, Dvar Torah number two goes as follows. There is a pasuk in Shmos at the beginning when Moshe Rabbeinu goes down to Egypt, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling him time to take the Jews out. Okay, so Paro obviously didn't want them to go. And there's a very interesting pasuk. It's Perek Vav, pasuk Yud Gimel. How do you remember that? Vav is what?
613.
Okay, so when you're sitting at the table and at your Siddurim, you say, I think it's Perek Vav, pasuk Yud Gimel, that it says like this, and you just have the mnemonic, 613. Okay, it goes like this. In Shmos, not Bereishis. So the pasuk says as follows, Hashem spoke to Moshe and Aaron and says to them as follows, I command you, you need to command the Jews and Paro to let the Jews out of Egypt. What's weird about that pasuk?
Why do you command the Jews to let the Jews out?
Why do you have to command the Jews to get... Exactly, Avi. Why do you have to command the Jews to let the Jews out? Who should be the first people who wants to get out of Egypt? They're in slavery. The Jews, right? You tell somebody who's enslaved, okay, guys, time to get out. Time you can get out of slavery. What are they going to want to do? They're going to be number one online fighting over who's going to get out first. Here the pasuk says that Moshe and Aaron were commanding. You need to command the Jews. We understand commanding Paro. Paro didn't want to let them out, but the Jews... So Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky tells the following story. He talks about the poor farmer who was a sharecropper. He paid 80% of his profits, of his yield, to the rich landowner, and he kept a measly 20%, which was not even enough to scrape on by. His family had to get by on that measly amount. They had one cow and a few chickens. The cow, they drank the milk, used the milk. The chickens, they used the eggs. Otherwise, life was miserable. And this is how it was year in, year out, year in, year out. Terrible lives, but that was life for them. That's what they got acclimated to. That's what they became accustomed to. One day, this poor farmer, miserable farmer, but that's life, he goes to the marketplace, hears terrible news, comes back. His wife sees him and says, what happened? Looks like a calamity is happening. What happened? You look ashen gray. He says, terrible news. They're talking in the marketplace that the Messiah is coming and he's going to take us to Israel. This is the worst thing. How are we going to live? How are we going to support ourselves? What's going to happen with our cow? What's going to happen with our chickens? Who's going to put a shelter over our head? And his wife, who was a very religious lady, says as follows, don't worry, my dear husband. The Lord has protected us throughout history. He protected us from Paro in Egypt. He protected us from Haman at the time of Purim. He has protected us throughout the exile, and I am sure that he will protect us from this Messiah also. And the message that Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky learned from this is this farmer was stuck in a rut. And when time goes on and somebody's stuck in a rut, in a bad situation, they get accustomed to it and they have a difficult time changing, to the effect that change becomes their greatest enemy. And it could be, for example, a bad relationship that somebody has had. You're stuck with this roommate for a few years. You just, it's miserable, but I'm just going to bear it out. And what it dictates when you're in a rut and having a tough time is to make a change. But sometimes when we get so deep in that rut, we just accept it and don't try to look for anything better. And that's why Klal Yisrael was stuck in Egypt. And they, after 210 years, they didn't have any expectations of being able to get out of it. Change became their worst enemy. They just said, okay, this is life. We're never getting out of here. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Moshe and Aaron, not only command Paro, but you need to also command the Jews themselves that they need to make a change here. Okay, so that is number two. That's an important lesson also that we should take through our lives. Number three goes as follows, guys. One of the plagues was Tzfardea? What does Tzfardea mean?
Frogs.
What does it mean?
Frogs.
Tzfardea. What does it mean?
A frog.
A frog. It's good we have an Israeli boy here. He's corrected all of us. He said it's a frog. Tzfardea is frog, not frogs. Okay?
Frogs?
What? How do you say it's frogs? How do you say frogs? How do you say frogs?
Frogs?
Yeah, frogs, how do you say? Lashon Rabim. Tzfardeim. Okay, Tzfardeim. Tzfardeim is one, Tzfardeim is multiple. Not Tzfardeim, Tzfardeim. Frogs.
You guys come from one.
It's with a tzadi, not a samach. Okay, so the pasuk, when it's talking about the plague of frogs, says that a frog came out of the Nile, right? It says Tzfardea, a single frog. And the frog ascended and it covered the land of Egypt. I'll give you a parallel to this. I remember growing up in Los Angeles, I used to go to camp in Camp Warasha in the Poconos. Okay, so I used to fly out from Los Angeles. Relative, either my father used to come with me or used to have a relative pick us up. So one time when I went, my uncle Chaim Wasserman picked me up. And from the airport, and we went out to lunch at some restaurant in Brooklyn somewhere. And on the menu was meatballs, or meatball. I don't remember exactly if it had the S or not, so I said, sounds good. They brought me a plate with one meatball on it. The meatball was almost, it was bigger than a softball. Bigger than a softball. Sitting on a plate, one meatball. And, you know, but try to eat that. And I was like, oh my goodness, I'm only halfway through. And it's like cutting another layer off. There's another layer. And it was like, it was one meatball. So that's what happened here. We have a book called Parsha Mesaperli. It's in English, Yiddish, and Hebrew. So it's like a kid's. Yeah, we have it. No, we have the Hebrew one. So it's a Parsha Mesaperli. It has five volumes on the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. And it has pictures of all the parshas. And when it comes to the Tzfardea, that's right, there are other volumes also. So when it comes to Megillah, so when it comes to the frog, the ten plagues, the frog, it has one massive, the picture is one massive frog coming out of the Nile. That's what it is, one frog. So it's Friday. So what does Rashi bring to the Rashi? It says, there was one frog that came out, and what did the Egyptians do? They hit it. And what happened, Max?
Split.
And then what did they do again? They hit it. And it split. And it split. Will be the logical thing to do. Stop hitting the frog. Wake up, smell the coffee. Avi! So the stifler, he says, the stifler asked the question, why didn't they stop hitting the frog? So you hit it on the head. When somebody loses their cool, what do?
They use their fists.
They act irrationally. They lose their ability to act logically. And they do things that are counterproductive. They do things that only negatively impact them. The right thing for them to do was stop hitting the frog. That's the logical thing to do. But unfortunately, they got into the cycle of getting more and more and more angry. And that's when you're really, really angry, what do? You can't stop yourself. You just get more and more. And we can all, at some point in our lives, probably relate to this, that we've been irritated and angered and disgusted, and we get into the cycle of getting more and more upset. And unfortunately, that's what happened there. So there's actually a Gemara that says that, effectively, that's talking about somebody who gets upset occasionally. But how about somebody who's always upset? Who's always irritated? Who's always angry? The Gemara in Nedarim says, "Kol mine gehenim sholtim bo."
Someone said
Gehenim. Kol mine, all types of gehenim are governing him. All types of gehenim are what are controlling that person. What does that mean? So we may think that the simple explanation is when he goes up to heaven or hell, he's going to punish. In all types of gehenim, all types of punishments is what he's going to have. But Yerucham Levavitz gives a different explanation. It says somebody who's constantly angry is not only going to be punished and in Gehenna in the world to come, but this person in this world is living in Gehenna because he's constantly irritated and upset. And that's what Kol Mine Gehenna Sholtimbo means, that he's always going to be irritated. He's living in Gehenna. And obviously that is not the mita that we, the place that we want to be. So we learn from here. Lesson number three is that try to avoid getting into that cycle of angry, the anger. That's what we learned from the stipe. That's what we learned from the hitting of the frog. Because if you get into that angry mode, what happens? You lose your logic. You lose your rationality.
Slow to anger, slow to sin.
Very good.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Josh. Okay, number four. Here we go. This is a beautiful Dvar Torah. Okay, listen up. Number four goes as follows. Coming the Seder, unless something changes quickly, we will be lacking something that is critical for the Seder. What is that? Korban Pesach. Korban Pesach we don't have. Now, there is a discussion in the poskim of can you bring a Korban Pesach nowadays? We don't, obviously. Why?
Because we don't know what the Yidden Asha.
We don't have we don't know. We have the base of mikdash. We don't have the mizbeach. We don't have the ability to do it nowadays.
Only those guys who do it anyway.
They try to.
The temple.
Okay, we're talking mainstream, normal people. So at the Seder we are going to unfortunately be lacking having the Korban Pesach. Why don't we have the Korban Pesach? Why don't we have the base of mikdash nowadays? Why was it destroyed? We're in Galus, even here. We're in Galus from the base of Mikdash. It was destroyed. Why? Sina Schinam. What does Sina Schinam mean? Sina means baseless hatred. Sina means hatred. Chinam is free. Baseless hatred caused the destruction of the base of Mikdash. Sina Schinam. So the Ben Ish Chai, who was a Sfaradi with a Samach, not a Tzadi, not a frog, Sfaradi, a Gaon. A big Kabbalist, asks an excellent question. He says, so if the basis for our not having the Korban Pesach is because we don't have the base of Mikdash, and that's because of Sina Schinam, why don't we talk about Sina Schinam at all at the Seder? That we should wipe away Sina? It's a good question. If that's why we don't have the Korban Pesach, let's discuss at the Seder, let's get rid of Sina Schinam. We don't have that discussion at the Seder. So he says something beautifully. Indeed, we do have a remez, an allusion to Sinas Chinam at the Seder. What is it? So one of the Manishtanas, one of the various Manishtanas, why is this night different from other nights? So different reasons we have. One of them is on every night we don't dip, and on tonight we have
two dippings.
Right?
We need
two dippings. What are the two dippings that we have? Number one is?
Tomorrow?
We dip into the, that's the second... The first one is carpus into the salt water, and the second one is into the charosis. So he says as follows. He says something absolutely beautiful. The first dipping that we have at the Seder into the salt water is in place of, is an allusion to the first dipping that we have in the Tanakh. What's the first dipping? If you think back, Sefer Bereishis, what's the first time something was dipped? That wasn't dipping. Well, louder. The coat of Yosef was dipped into the blood. Joseph's technicolor dream coat, right? So that, when I was in elementary school, we were it. And if I remember correctly, Avshalom Katz, who's Eitan Katz's and Shlomo Katz's father, the singer. So Avshalom Katz was at the Hillel Hebrew Academy back then. Adam, listen up. So he was at Hillel Hebrew Academy. So he was the youth and music person, and we were in Joseph the eighth grade, just Joseph the technicolor dream coat. So I was Reuven at a big R Reish, sorry Reish on my sackcloth that I was wearing, my brown toga, effectively is what we were all wearing. Okay, so that's exactly correct. The first dipping was the dipping of Joseph's coat into the blood, and then they went to Yaakov and they said, "Dear father, what's going on here?" He says, "Oh, Joseph must have been attacked by an animal. He must be no longer." But that dipping represents the original dipping of the ultimate example of Sinas Chinam between the brothers. There was baseless hatred between the brothers. They went and they fake killing him. That was Sinas Chinam. What do we do now at the Seder? We're remembering that Sinas Chinam by dipping into the salt water. And the second dipping that we have at the Seder into the Charosis represents the second dipping in the Tanakh. What's the second dipping into the Tanakh? Think Pesach.
When they put you...
Dipping the brush into the blood.
Oh, excellent. And that was called the Aguda. The Aguda's Ezov was the hyssop brush, whatever it was, the Aguda that they used. They dipped into the blood of the Korban Pesach and they painted the doorpost and the lintel, the mashkof, thank you, and they painted it. That represents a blood of unity because the word is Aguda. What does Aguda mean? Help me out here.
Unity.
That's Gvina. Aguda.
Naguda.
It is, but what does it mean?
Unity.
Unity, thank you. It means unity. They use Achtus, unity. So this is the dipping. This second dipping is not a dipping of Sinas Chinam, but it is a dipping of Achtus, of unity. And says the Ben Yishai beautifully, it's the second dipping that is coming as a kapara, to do away, to fix the first dipping. It's the second dipping of Achdus. It's the dipping that's represented by the painting of the blood on the mashkof of the doorpost that is coming to fix up the sin of the Sina Schina of Yosef and his brother. So we do have the allusion to Sina Schina with the dippings at the Seder. Now, just to take one more step on that, Rav Elchanan Wasserman says that if we've looked at what the claim has been against Jews throughout the centuries, there's one specific claim that the Christians claim against us. What do we do? What's the blood libel? That we do what? Kill the kids and we use the blood for the matzah. Why is matzah white and not red? So Rav Elchanan says this makes absolutely no sense. Is blood permitted for a Jew to eat?
No.
That's the last thing we will want to do is to have blood. It absolutely makes no sense. So Rav Elchanan says, how is it that centuries and centuries and centuries later we still have this claim against Klal Yisrael? So Rav Elchanan says as follows. He suggests that this is a divine punishment that corresponds to the sin of they dipped Yosef's coat into the blood. This is because of the Sina Sinam that existed at the time.
Yes.
Okay, the regular, the cookies. That's why they're all here. Glad we came to Shir. Free food.
Let's put a picture in the chat.
This is it. As we speak about Pesach, the cookies will go around, say a bracha. There's enough for eight for each person.
Yes.
Okay, so Rav Elchanan says as follows. Rav Elchanan suggests, not by name, we have the same name, I have his name. He suggests that this is a divine punishment. The blood libel is a divine punishment because of the Sina Schinam, the blood of the dipping of Yosef's brothers. And he says, when the brothers dip Yosef's coat into blood, that did something to the system of heavenly justice, which caused Jews in future generations to be susceptible to the slanderous libel that we bake our matzahs with the blood of Gentile children.
Wow.
So that is very powerful. That since the blood libel is a result, says the Rav Elchanan, of the Sina Schinam and the dipping of the blood by Yosef's brothers. Now to go the next step, Rabbi Sachs, anyone from England? Oh, Zach? Rabbi Sachs, who was the an Avi. He was the chief.
Zach's mom is the chief of staff of Rabbi Sachs.
Really? Fantastic. She does a good job. So he wrote a beautiful article just now. It just got published March 27th, a few days ago, published in Newsweek, and it's called this, Anti-Zionism is the New Anti-Semitism. Read this. It is fantastic. It is accurate. It is unfortunate that we have to deal with this. And effectively, he's saying that everyone is couching what's going on in the world, anti-Israel, BDS, all of this Narishkeit as anti-Israel. It's just the same plain old anti-Semitism that we have experienced for hundreds and thousands of years. And he says that, I'm going to read two paragraphs from here, but read the whole thing, because this relates exactly to what we're saying. Anti-Semitism, this first sentence that I'm about to read is amazing. Anti-Semitism is a virus that survives by mutating. Very powerful statement. Very powerful statement. In the Middle Ages, Jews were hated because of their religion. In the 19th and 20th centuries, they were hated because of their race. Today, they are hated because of their nation-state Israel. Anti-Zionism is the new anti-Semitism. And he continues, and guys who go back to the campuses, you will unfortunately be you will experience this.
YU.
Baruch Hashem. You going to YU?
Yeah.
Wow. All right. The legitimization has also changed. Throughout history, listen up, throughout history, when people have sought to justify anti-Semitism, they have done so by recourse to the highest source of authority available within the culture. In the Middle Ages, it was religion. In post-Enlightenment Europe, it was science. Today, it is human rights. Everything is couched as human rights. It is why Israel, the only fully functioning democracy in the Middle East, with a free press and independent judiciary, and the independent judiciary includes Arab judges, is regularly accused of the five crimes against human rights: racism, apartheid, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and attempted genocide. And he ends off with the following statement: this is the blood libel of our time. This is the blood libel of... So this is continuing, as Rav Elchanan said. We see the Sinas Chinam, and that's represented by the dipping, the first dipping that we have into the salt water. That is in place. That symbolizes the Sinas Chinam, the dipping of Yosef's coat by the brothers. And unfortunately, says the Rav Elchanan Wasserman, until this day, we are still suffering in the form of the blood libel, the blood libel as a punishment for that initial sin of Sinas Chinam. Unbelievable. Okay. Last of the Divrei Torah, and then we're going to have some time to go through some halachic shailas. It goes as follows. There's a Gemara in Brachos, Yud Zayin on a Man Aleph, that says as follows. Rebbe Alexandri, Basar Damasli Amar Hachi. So Rebbe Alexandri, after he davened the Shemoneh Esrei, he would say as follows. Ribono Olamim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Creator of the world, Galui V'adua Lefanecha, it is known unto you, that we want to do your desire. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we so urgently want to do what you want us to do. However, what prevents us from fulfilling what we should be doing? So the Gemara says as follows. He brings two answers. Se'or Shebe'isa. What's Se'or Shebe'isa? The Chametz. The Chametz keeps us from doing the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the leavening agent that we use in the bread that we make, v'shibud malchuyos, and the oppression of the governments that are oppressive to us, v'shibud malchuyos. Those are the two things that are preventing us from doing the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And he ends off by saying, yihiratzo milfanecha shetatzileinu miyadam HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it should be your will to save us from their hands, v'nashuv lasos chukei retzoncha b'levav shalom, and you should return us in order to be able to fulfill your will. So the question is, these two things that are preventing us, one is chametz, and one is the oppressive governments, what exactly does this mean? So the Marsha explains as follows. Marsha gives beautiful explanations of the agadic parts of the Gemara. So he says, the Rambam tells us that we should always be going in the middle path, the golden norm, the golden mean. Don't go too far to the right, to the extreme, don't go far to the left. We should always try to maintain the Derech HaMelech, the king's path, the Shvil Azav, the golden mean. So he says that these two concepts are trying to get us off of that path, either to the excess or the opposite of the excess. And he says as follows, when it comes to the Soor Shebi'isa, when it comes to the leavening agent, what it tries to do is to make us excessively arrogant, excessively promiscuous, excessively trying to bring us all the way to the right side of the path. We try to stay in the middle, and it tries to make us go into the extreme. That's what the Se'or Shebi'isa, that's what the Chametz tries to do. That it tries to kindle our Yetzer Hara to really make it inflame. And on the other side, when we have oppression, either by governments or other forces that are trying to push us off of the path also, it's trying to not inflate us, but to deflate us from doing the desires of a Kodesh Baruch. It's trying to make us feel we're too lowly to do anything. It's trying to take us away our ability to be an Oved Hashem. And what we need to try to do is stay on that middle path. So what I want to just try to explain is this connection, that it's the Yetzer Hara that's equated to the Chametz. The Chametz is trying to make us feel excessive. It's trying to make us feel too proud, take us off the middle path of worship God. What exactly does that mean? So I think one explanation goes as follows, that the concept here is that the Yetzer Hara works with time. Meaning, it usually, how does it start, the Yetzer Hara? Starts big or starts slow?
Slow.
Starts slow. And it works on you. And it works on you. And it grows. And it grows. We've talked about this when we talked about Yichud and shaking hands with women. That it starts, ah, she's not attractive. And then it grows. And it grows. And over time, is it months or is it 2 years? Or is it that dentist that had the 10 years after 10 years? If you remember back a number of months ago, but 10 years later, 10 years later, she's attracted to him. So that's the Yetzer Hara. It goes with time. It starts slow. The Gemara tells that initially the Yetzer Hara looks like a cobweb. It's very thin, very thin threads. And then it really comes out as a very, it tries to drag us with a very strong rope. Right? It starts slow and then it tries to, that's the Yetzer Hara. And that's the same concept with chametz. That chametz changes over time. It starts slow, right? What's the difference between non-chametz and chametz?
Rising
time. 18 minutes and 90 minutes. You go from 18 minutes to 90 minutes. That is the whole difference. So that's the same concept. That is when we say that the Gemara says that it's the Yetzer Hara represented by chametz that's trying to get us off course. That's what it's saying. It's trying to get us off course. The Yetzer Hara is trying to kick us in with time. It works just like chametz. Just so over chametz, it works on us so too. So that's one explanation. Another explanation goes as follows. I was told this by Rav Tovia Rodberg. He says the concept of chametz is that chametz, when you add a leavening agent to your ingredients, it makes it look something, it looks like something that it's not. It gives it a lot better appearance. For example, if you just put water and a flour together, what do you get?
Matzah.
Add what?
Yeast.
A leavening agent. Add yeast, which is effectively the same thing. But it looks unbelievable. It looks so powerful. It looks great. But really, what is it? It's matzah. Same as matzah. So the same thing with the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara gives us the illusion of something being much better than it really is. For example, somebody wants to do a sin. That looks great. This is exciting. This is going to be amazing. Afterwards, never was as good as the anticipation going into it. It says that's the same thing. That's the same thing with the Yetzer Hara. Gives off that illusion, just like the chametz gives us that illusion. They're both giving off an illusion, masking the reality of what's underneath. So that's also, now we can understand why Rabbi Alexandri, when he says, what's taking us off path, off the task of fulfilling God's will, it's the Sor Shebi Isha. It's that Yetzer Hara that's giving us a skewed view of the world, making it look much more exciting to sin. It's giving us that Yetzer Hara, but truth be told, it's never as good going in. It's never as good after the fact as it was going in. Okay, so that's the last of the Divrei Torah. I want to ask you guys some questions, and I want to see how you paskin on this. Okay, so as follows. It was a guy who decided, I want to take care of people who can't afford matzah. So what he decided, build big tzedakah, big baal tzedakah. He dedicates $10,000. People are going to come to his gemach. Whoever can't afford matzah, come and I'll give them the money to go buy matzah. That's what it was. People were coming, giving them money, giving them money, and they would go buy matzah. Maybe give a voucher, whatever. But I dedicated $10,000.
Matzah's ready already.
Could be, but maybe they wanted their own taste of matzah. I'll go to business, I'll go to blah, 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 so I'll give them money. So that's what he decided to do. $10,000. People are coming. How many kids do you have? How much do you need? It would give him, he would supply the needs. Somebody comes to him once, and as follows, the donor says to him, how can I help you? How many matzahs do you need? So he says, he stutters. He says, I have matzah. I'm okay on the matzah. But what I need is, I need teeth. He had no teeth in his mouth. I can't eat any matzah. I can't, even if it's softened, can't eat the matzah because I don't have teeth. I need some money to go to the dentist and have implants or dentures supplied to me. So the donor says, Ani nora mitzter yakiri. I feel terrible, my dear friend, but the kesef that I'm giving is not for teeth. I'm giving money for matzah, not teeth. I'm not buying people teeth. I'm not buying implants and dentures. It's for matzah. So the guy responds, not talking very clearly. He says as follows, you know, your whole intention is to enable people to do what? To fulfill the mitzvah matzah. Right. To fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. And the same for me. I have the matzah, but I can't fulfill the matzah, the mitzvah without teeth. So you, it's the same thing. Yeah, you dedicated $10,000. You should be using some of your money. That would enable me to do the mitzvah. And that question was posed to Rav Zilberstein. Who is right? Is the donor right who says it's only for matzah? Or is the person who's asking for the money... What was that? The person that needs the teeth?
Yeah.
Why?
Because without teeth he cannot eat matzah.
Ah, so it's...
And he's giving it for the use of matzah.
Okay, good. Very good, Avi.
Yeah, but I would say he can... Because he set the money aside to give for the mitzvah of matzah, I'd say he can give it to him, the guy with teeth.
Let's see what he said.
Specifically,
10,000 litzorek for the need. You know, it doesn't have his language here. It just $10,000 was dedicated for people kniat matzot mitzvah. But it's not a quote. It's like his purpose, his intention was for people to buy.
His intention was for people to fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. Yes, this would help the guy fulfill the mitzvah of matzah. But with the amount of money to spend on getting dentures or teeth implants,
it's
going to
take away a lot from
another 100. 250 boxes of matzah.
So it would take away. Let's assume it's not going to take away from other people.
No, but he said it was
$10,000. $10,000? I don't know if it was if this was in Yerushalayim, that would go pretty quickly, or if it's like in Podunk, Iowa, that or like or Hendon, UK, or something.
Well, what would he do with leftover
mitzvah?
Rebbe.
Probably maybe wait for the next year.
Rebbe, the mitzvah was to provide people with matzahs. Mm-hmm. The mitzvah wasn't to make sure people eat matzahs. So it's two different things.
So you would say...
I'm using this matzah so that everybody can fulfill the mitzvah. He said, I'm using this money so that people who don't have matzahs...
Can have matzahs. So you disagree with Yakir. So you disagree with Yakir. With Yakir, this boy. You disagree with him. That's okay.
His intentions are made clear, though.
Which is...
We don't have a quote saying this is my intention.
Yeah, it's unclear. It's unclear. You're saying okay, but you know, he's saying, but the guy without the dentures saying your intention was to enable people, whichever way. Okay, so that's the question. Let's get to the answer that he brought. This boy did not hear these in advance. I want to say okay. So he says as follows: there's a pasuk Shmos Yud Bet pasuk Dalet that says im yimata bat miyos miseh. The way that the korban pasuk works is you would have your one for your family, and if it was too much, you'd get other people together to participate in the korban pesach together. So the Gemara in Pesachim Tzadi Amudal says as follows: what was that?
You have to eat the whole korban pesach.
It was a prohibition to go into the next day. You can't lo yashirim memenu aboker. So that's good. My bar mitzvah parshas baal oscha, so that's pesach sheni. So very good. We'll lane the haftorah afterward together. All right. So. Batzion. So, okay. So we'll continue. Okay, so the Gemara then says, what if you have your Korban Pesach, but you don't have enough money for example, for the wood to burn the Korban Pesach? So it says you can get together with other people, bring them in as partners, and you would supply, you have the animal, and they could supply... the wood. They could supply the wood. So how can they just supply the wood? They're not participating in the korban. So the Gemara says as follows: the kaven de katan. I'm breaking my feet, my teeth here. I'm going to need the denture soon. De takanta de pesachu. It's necessary for the korban pesach. Kegufa de pesach nami. It's as if it is the korban pesach. Also, it's the same thing whether you participate in the Korban Pesach, because that other person is enabling the bringing of the Pesach. It doesn't matter whether he's giving the Korban or he is giving the wood to bring the Korban. So based on that, Rav Zilberstein said what, Max? Based on it, to answer our question?
Then you would be retired to
give it. He would. That's whether you're giving the matzah or giving the dentures, it's the same thing, because you are ultimately, the concept was you're enabling, so Yakir here was right. Sorry, Zaki. So he was right that he didn't. There was no cheating involved.
He
guessed 50-50. So Baruch Hashem, he guessed right. So here he comes out saying this is the takanta de matzos ukegufa de matzos. You know, the same concept here, that by giving the dentures, that's as if he's giving matzos because he's enabling somebody to be doing the mitzvah. Yeah.
It's not comparable, though. Just because
because you're enabling someone to do it, that's great. But in the case of the dentures, you're, I guess, in a way, disabling other people from wrong.
But that's another point.
You know, he doesn't address that point. I think then we would say that really, this is what Avi was saying before also, like, you're going to take away 100 people. If there's, like, if he's number 3 on 9 and there are another 1,000 people after him, I think it's a different question probably. Because we so were, it's a, so it's assuming that it wouldn't take away. I think we have to assume that.
Well,
okay, that was.
If he was number 3 on 9, I would give him, like, the monetary equivalent of
the matzah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. I like that. Okay, next question, guys. Here we go. We have two or three more after this. Okay, so there was a husband and wife. They were not well off. And they got into a unheated discussion between the two. A couple. Married husband and wife. Unheated discussion. Erev Pesach. They don't have a lot of money. They have enough money to buy one of them clothing.
One of them,
new clothing for Pesach.
The
husband says, I want to buy you new clothing for Pesach. And the wife says, no, I want you, hold on, I want you to buy yourself because your Bekesha is tattered. Your Bekesha is tattered. You should buy yourself new clothing. And she says two reasons. Number one, Simchas Yontif. I will have Simchas Yontif by your, she says. The
right,
wife
so
says, I will have Simchas Yontif by your wearing new clothing. I will have Simchas Yontif by your wearing new clothing, she says to the other man. And number two, it's Kavod HaTorah. You're a big Talmud Chacham. You should not be walking around with tattered clothing. So I know both of us need new clothing. We haven't bought for quite a while, but she wants him to buy for himself. He wants her to buy for herself. And the question was posed, what should be the wife? What?
She
should get the clothing.
Yeah,
I'm with him.
Yeah,
the husband to
her
wife,
the wife
every.
But she is saying, my Simchas Yontif is seeing my husband with new clothing.
So that would be the satisfaction.
So that's what you do.
So Joy, but what's the halacha then, Joy? She does. She knows.
But
she's saying it's subjective. My simcha is not by my. I'm going to be happier by my husband. I don't know if that fits.
As soon as she said, that, it means that the obligation of him to buy herself.
Such a nice man.
Says she needs it.
Uh-huh. So,
so
you're saying it's subjective.
The obligation of the husband is only to provide for his wife what she requires and what she needs. But as soon as she says she doesn't need it,
then she's okay.
Then she's okay.
Can we opt out of this?
Do they have money for a kittel and a new?
They only have enough for one. Enough money for one, not both.
Do they have
how much is
a
new
Bekesha?
It's either she gets a dress or he gets a Bekesha. One or the other.
Are they the same price of Bekesha and a dress?
55 shekel each.
For the sake of the
audience, I have no clue. Okay, so quick answer here. He says the Kaf HaChaim says being on a malbushim when it comes to clothing, the woman comes before the husband. She comes first. And what about her claim that she has more Simchas Yontif from him wearing clothing? He says, as the poskim say, that the simcha of a woman and Yontif has to be through something tangible, jewelry, clothing. It is not in a metaphysical concept that she feels subjectively happier when her husband has more clothing. You would. I plead the fifth on that, but halachically yes.
You're not an American, Rebbe. You're not American.
Halachically yes.
Constitutional rights.
Halachically yes. I say please go buy yourself something. I can't do it myself. I will not choose correctly. That's also not good for Shalom Bayit. So. But the answer is yes. Okay. So you were right. You guessed two for two. Good. Okay. Great work. You know. Quit while you're ahead. So he leads to the next question. You're doing great. You're doing fantastic. So the next question that he has here is, this is more of a statement. He says there was a maisa.
You know, when 24 came to your house, you gave him all the answers to the question.
What?
Like a student that came to your house, you gave him all the answers, like surprisingly.
No, that would take away all the fun.
That's so funny.
So he brings a maisa, a similar maisa, that there was the husband owed money to somebody coming into Yontif, and the wife says, don't buy me something new. My simcha is by your paying down our debts. That will bring me more simcha and yontif than you're buying me something
new.
And the question, why was that?
It's a tangible
That no, but it's not tangible. She's not getting something physical. So the question is then, should he pay?
That's not tangible.
It's still not tangible. Still not. Should she pay down the debt? Should he pay down the debt, or should he buy her clothing or jewelry for Yom?
Just make her more agitated.
We'll just make.
They have debt. She'll just make her more agitated.
One
second.
I don't think that'll help. That I won't give her something.
So you would say pay down the debt?
Yeah.
Okay, anyone else?
If it's intangible, then how can you possibly go against halacha?
So it's if something pay down the debt?
Is it always halacha that way, Rabbi?
So.
But it's also a mitzvah of paying back the
it's also, and it's a chiyuv to pay back the debt. He throws in a curveball here. There are certain things that are not included. I'll cut a straw with the sides between Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, what our budget is going to be, what our receipts are going to be. There are certain things that are carved out, they're not included, which is, for example.
Pay back loans.
Nope.
Oh, sorry, the paying for the wife.
Nope. Uses of Shabbos? Broader. Zaki, it's broader. What we spend on Shabbos and what we spend on Yantif.
Sorry, what was my
So name? Because that is not included in our budget, meaning it's not included in what we receive from Kodesh Baruch Hu, we get extra for that, then he says we should buy her clothing because that's not included in
so
the
he
budget.
Wasn't supposed use to do the that money. Anyways now.
Use the money to buy her clothing. However, then he says that however, if it is unreasonable to expect that you'll otherwise be able to pay the debt, meaning it's clear that it's one or the other, and we're going to have no money to pay the debt, then you should pay the debt down. But if it's not the case, if you think you'll be able to have money to pay the debt, so that's what it depends.
A nicer gift to pay back the debt.
So he's saying as follows: buy her the clothing, but. And don't pay down the debt because if there's assuming that there's a reasonable chance you can pay down the debt anyway, then right now in the future you earn money, buy her the clothing. Otherwise, if there's no way you're going to be able to pay the debt if you spend this money, then pay down the debt. Okay, next question. We are going quickly here. Following happened, there was a rav erev Pesach. Any bechorim here that have to fast? Max, just one. Okay, so you got a fax. You're at the shul. Where are we going to be davening? What shul?
Somewhere in Netanya.
You go to shul. Every shul is going to have, you go to Shachris. Every shul is going to have a siyum. Rabbi is there. He's giving the siyum. And all of a sudden he hears, Rabbi, include me, please. Don't forget me. He looks around. A bunch of people standing around. Somebody points towards the table. There's a cell phone there that is on speaker. And somebody is listening. This happened to me once. We had a minion. Right at our work, we were in a building, fifth floor. The office that I was in. Second floor, we had a minion, mincha 1:30, whatever time it was. And all of a sudden, I hear somebody on a speaker. There's a cell phone sitting there when we're davening, and he's answering.
What?
He's trying to participate via minion via
what?
Speaker. You can't do that. So,
he
but
can be part of a minion.
How about? Maybe. Certain, it's a shayla.
What?
It's a shayla.
You're not supposed to.
No,
that's not what
it means. It's a shayla. No, it does. It does. It does. So. So. Get the book. Get the book on main. There's a whole book on it. Okay. So. The rabbi here is at the siyum saying, thinking to himself, can you participate? And assume via a cell phone if you're not in attendance. And that is the question that's posed to you guys.
Yes.
What do you think? Joe, yes?
Shimashas is broadcasted.
Well, that is just listening. Here the question is, he's a Bechor. Is he allowed to eat as if he's a participant in the Siyum? It's different.
Yeah,
it's not just I'm being inspired by the Siyum Hashash by watching the hookup.
Just like you can't participate in a minion, I don't see the difference. Yeah.
So Zaki wants to say, just like a minion, you can't
participate. That's a riot, you can't do it. I'm saying.
You're not allowed to?
I don't think it's the same as a minion, but I do think.
I don't think it's the same as a minion.
Why
can't you?
I don't think you can because I think that presence is key to everything. As in, if you're not actually there, then I don't think you can be part of it.
Yeah, but a siyum might be different, though. I don't know. I'm trying
to
think. A siyum, you have a chiyuv.
Yeah. Otherwise, he's fast.
He never finished
anything.
The rabbi's finishing. If you're there, wow.
No.
So he says,
to be
either...
For the Suda Smith, so no.
Are you included in the Suda?
So he's saying as follows, it's in order to be included in the siyum, you have to show what's important to you. and you're not even coming. Now, I could say, what if happens if the person just couldn't come? I don't know. But Lemaisa says you cannot be included. He comes out. I don't know if there's an exigent circumstance clause there here, but under normal circumstances, you would have to come in order to be included in a siyum. You could not do it. What was that? Yeah, I don't know. And there's no one who I did a siyum, and you're really hungry. What?
Do you need a minion?
No. You don't need a minion. You don't, yeah. You don't need a minion. Okay, last question. Last question. Goes as follows. There was a Reuven, the proverbial Reuven. Erev Pesach, Shimon comes up to him and says, you know, I'm going away for Pesach. Reuven, my dear friend, I have a few $1,000 that I need watched. I need it in a safe place. I'm scared of leaving it in my house. We're not going to be around. Can I leave this money with you? Reuven says, absolutely not a problem. I'll keep it for you. Over Pesach, when you get home, give me a call. I'll give you the money back. What happened? Lel HaSeder is Lel Shi Murim. Lel Shi Murim is the night of protection. We don't even say the Kriya Shema Lamita and everything because we're protected.
Which night is
this? The Lel HaSeder, the night of the Seder. Lel Shi Murim. Like the Kali Yisrael was protected. That was the... I say the Shema itself. Lel Shimurim is brought down Lalacha. It's Lel Shimurim. It's the night that Klal Yisrael was protected. Email me. I'll send it to you. Just like Klal Yisrael protected Machas Bechoros, so too we are protected. So what did he do? He left his door unlocked. Lel Shimurim, night of protection. Robbers came in, stole the money. Shimon comes back and says, where'd my money? Reuven says, it got stolen. Shimon says, pay me back. Reuven says, I don't have to pay you back. If you look in Shulchan Aruch, in the Magen Avraham in the Shulchan Aruch, he says as follows, Kasav Maharil, the Magen Avraham brings the Maharil, Lel HaSeder, which is Lel Shimurim, the night of protection, Lo Yinol Et Adelet Bebaria Chazak, you don't have to lock your door with strong locks. You don't have to lock up. So he says, that's what Eli Paskin. That's how he says. So Reuven says, I'm not responsible, which says it in the Magen Avraham. You don't have, this is the night of protection. I got broken into, it's not my problem.
Cool,
and Shimon case. Says, it is your problem. This question was asked to Rav Eliashiv.
What, this happened recently?
Leave the door open?
He left it closed but unlocked. Rav Eliashiv, great question. Rav Eliashiv asked that they walked right. They tried the door. They walked right in, and they found the money and they stole it. And Rav Eliashiv was asked this question: does Reuven have to pay back Shimon or not? What do you guys think on this one?
I'm so happy Rav Eliashiv answered 6 weeks ago. That's crazy.
What do we think?
The question was answered is it considered negligent?
Is it very good? If he's high of a negligence, was he negligent or was he okay leaving the door? I'm happy.
I think it was negligent.
It was negligence.
He doesn't like.
Why? But he's. But it says in the Maril, you don't have to lock your door.
I don't think they meant that literally. I don't think that's literally.
So exactly what they now literal. It's brought in the Magen Avraham.
That you're not allowed to lock your door.
That you don't have to. Lo yino. It says don't. Lo yino. Don't do it. Show your bitichot. This is Bel Shimurim.
And also that very much depends on your neighborhood. Like if your neighborhood is going to be somewhere where no one's going to be around, who cares?
Good.
Be somewhere where you're going to get robbed, then it's a big deal.
So he says 2 points. Excellent point. And then I'm going to add one last one. Number one, he says Reuven has to pay Shimon back. He absolutely does. Number one, if Reuven wants to leave his own door open when he only has his own assets at risk, that's one thing. But to put somebody else's assets... Maril is a big zach to listen to. It's a very important thing. But he says, if you want to put somebody else's assets at risk, you need permission for that. So that's point number one. Point number two, as Avi said, it also depends the neighborhood. If this is a neighborhood that is at risk, that there are a lot of break-ins... We obviously shouldn't be leaving our doors unlocked, even though the Mariel says he's talking about a normal neighborhood. It's not risky. Okay, Lel Shimurim. That's point number two. Point number three, I would add on, if you look at the strict language of the Mariel, it says, you don't lock your door, Bibariah Chazak. What's a Bariah?
A strong lock.
A strong deadbolt. But lock it anyway. You don't have to lock all four of them.
Sure,
you have to. The whole Gansa Mizu, but at least... at least a little bit seichel should be used here. So for those three reasons, right? Sure, mine is the third. Rabbi Elisha's is it? But he's
not
you
said.
Ah, oh, come on, no one Reuven
should. So guys, we're out of time. It should be a chag kasher. He gets in. He has his own way. Chag kasher v'sameach, and we will see you back. We'll see you back after Ben Ishmanim.